The International Association for Near-Death Studies presents NDE Radio, a weekly exploration of near-death experiences and similar encounters with the other side. Now, here's your host, Lee Whitting.
Welcome to NDE Radio, brought to you by IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies. I'm your host, Lee Whitting. Near-death experiencers typically report that after their heart stops beating and their soul leaves their body, that they carry with them the same intelligence, the same memories and personality as we generally attribute to the work of our brains. But if during the NDE the brain has stopped working, then what is the seat of this intelligence? And how does the brain learn about and communicate the experience after the soul's return? Today's guests, husband and wife Robert and Suzanne Bayes, are well known to longtime listeners of this show. They have studied the phenomena of near-death experiences together for over 35 years, although neither one has had an NDE. Their research focuses on the phenomena connected with the out-of-body components of NDEs, especially veridical perceptions and other verified paranormal phenomena during an NDE. Their theory of consciousness, the mind-entity hypothesis, is derived from NDE and neurological phenomena. It explains how the non-material mind interacts with the brain in ordinary consciousness. They wrote the foreword to the recent book, The Self Does Not Die, published by IANS, and their presentation at this year's IANS conference in Colorado can be found on YouTube. Their website is selfconsciousmind.com. Robert and Suzanne, welcome back to NDE Radio.
Thank you.
Hello, Lee.
Hi, Suzanne. Good to hear your voices.
Yeah.
Good. We had a little trouble with Skype today, so I'm doing this by phone myself. Let me begin by asking where your research has taken you since you were last on the program.
Well, we have pretty well, we think, solved the problem of exactly how the mind works with the brain. It took us several years to figure that out. And that's what we presented at the conference. So we think that we have a pretty good idea of how the mind interfaces with the brain and how the brain brings things to consciousness.
This has always been a fascinating thing to me, you know, trying to figure out how that works. If I understand correctly, in this year's conference talk, you said the mind is the essence of the person, but also that the mind depends on brain activity. And I was wondering, could talk a little about that.
Right. So the way we conceive the incarnated human being is that the mind, the non-material mind, is united with the brain and body. And basically, unless we have something like a near-death experience or some other kind of spiritually transformative experience, basically we are united with the brain throughout life. And so there has to be a way that the mind comes to consciousness, because when it's united with the brain and the brain stops working, we become unconscious. So anesthesiologists can give us a certain anesthetics and we are unconscious. Actually, you can just inhale a little bit of diethyl ether, which has actually is chemically inert in the body, and you lose consciousness. You fall asleep and you lose consciousness. You may dream, and that's another form of consciousness, but then your brain is working. So when the brain stops and we are still in our body, then we lose consciousness. And so we need the brain's activity to be conscious. When we're conscious all the time in waking state, and the brain is working all the time in waking state. So there's a good correlation there that gives the clue as to what's happening. In order to be conscious, you need the brain's activity.
Well, the brain is physical and electrical and chemical, but when you think of the mind, it seems to be a spiritual concept, and yet you're talking about their intercommunication all the time. And you did mention, I think, in your talk, the term intuition. So I was wondering what is intuition? I guess that's the question I'm asking.
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, there is interaction, even though you know, it's hard to conceive how that is, but there is interaction, because even in the NDE, there's interaction with when the person is, their locus of consciousness is in the physical world. They still perceive through light waves and sound waves, and actually have an interaction if they pass through a solid object like a wall. They have a subtle interaction with the physical material objects. But intuition is the mind side of bringing something to consciousness. In other words, when we perceive something, we have the senses, you know, visual or auditory, tactile senses, and we then have a perception. And there's a two-stage process. The first stage is to have what we call the percept. So you see something, and initially it is a jumble of unrelated things, and then immediately the mind has the intuition of what it is you're seeing, and you have, almost instantly, you recognize or you cognize what it is that you're seeing. So you see an object, and you know it's a book. But that's a two-stage process, and we give an example in the talk of what we call a hidden figure, which ordinarily to most people looks like just a bunch of blotches of black and white and makes no sense at all. But it is actually a picture of a man. And when you can get that, recognize that this is a man, a bearded man, and so on, you get the concept, and then you perceive it fully instead of just meaningless blotches. And so that gives you the sense of, okay, there's two stages. You have the percept, which is unrecognized, and then you have the mind getting the concept and applying it to the percept, and then you perceive, well, that is a picture of a man. So intuition is this process of the mind giving semantic content, conceptual content, to percepts, or the mind receiving ideas. Some people say downloads. You know, just ideas come to you, and that's all intuition.
And Lee, in our talk, we presented the aspect of that the human organization is an unusual organization, that we perceive the world through our physical senses, and then we have this other component, which is a spiritual component, which is this, where there's an organizing principle that cognizes and is able to bring the understanding, the intuition, to what is perceived physically through our senses. So what you had originally asked, well, is intuition a spiritual process? It most definitely is.
Yeah.
But it's because of our unusual organization that this is how we make sense of the world, is through our senses, just the objects perceiving, and then the other component is the spiritual component, the spiritual activity of cognizing, the intuition.
Or thinking, yeah.
Right. There's a whole process of maturing when a baby is born. The brain learns so much very quickly and begins to learn how to process what it sees and hears and so forth. But why, if the mind is so much in control, why aren't we born with full awareness and understanding?
Well, in a way, what's happening with an infant is that the infant needs to incarnate, basically, needs to learn how to use the body and the senses. So if you observe little children, well, infants, really, they are moving around, and they are also observing if their hand movements and so on, and observing things in the world, and with touch, with hearing, with sight, they are learning how to use their body, their senses. And then, of course, the child grows up to a toddler and learns language, of course, in this process as well, and then can speak, and then you will hear a lot of wisdom. That wisdom was there at the beginning, I'm certain, but you can't express it. But then 3-year-old or the 4-year-old will sometimes recount seeing things that most people don't see and knowing things that they couldn't have known in an ordinary way, having memories of a past life. So that wisdom is there. What you're observing is the process of the infant and the toddler and the 4 or 5-year-old coming into their body, basically.
It's a process of cognition coming into matter, into the physicality of the body, and a newborn, and then on up through. There's different stages of this development of intellect. And the earliest child, they're living in a world of pictures, of imaginations, the actual, what would you say, the archetypes of the spiritual world. And the process of the body growing is how to become a functional spiritual being having an earthly experience in a body. So this original mind essence, this cognition that we have before we're born, is finding its way from really being in the spiritual world to recognizing the objects of the outer world and how they relate to what they were born with, where they came from. And the body itself has to go through a process of growing the networks of the nerve system and the bones and everything. It's not automatically you take your first breath and everything is there for you. It's a long process of different 7-year phases that we go through. In the earliest child, it learns through a process of imitation and storytelling. So that's the beginning of helping the child to have a healthy and not forget where it's come from and how to begin to relate to the world of physicality that it's going to be immersed in.
Yeah. Do you suppose the child is autistic, or if somebody contracts Alzheimer's or has a brain injury, is there some way, do you suppose, that the mind could overcome that or take over for the damaged part of the brain?
Yes, in principle, yes. Some situations are really difficult, and autism is something that we have some, I would say, rudimentary sense of what's going on. But there is a way, and there are cases where an autistic a person that has a severe autism can overcome that. It requires actually almost developing this process that with normal child development happens naturally, but kind of working around whatever difficulties there are, and many of those difficulties probably have a neurological origin. With Alzheimer's, well, let's say with brain damage, okay, first of all, so one can have a traumatic brain injury or a stroke or something like that, and one can overcome those difficulties, but let's say the technology has not developed to make that obvious and automatic. Like, oh, you've had a left hemisphere stroke and you've lost your speech. Well, we'll do these exercises and then you'll be able to speak again. We're not there yet. But in principle, that is the case, that we can. But it will require, what basically it means is that the mind has to relearn where in the brain it is that it can function. And because we have 2 hemispheres and they have slightly different purposes or focuses, so the left brain is, you know, is always thought about as the area for speech and for intellectual abilities, and the right brain is for emotional and spatial and artistic abilities. And in fact, you can see this with EEG, that there is this differentiation. And so there's, for most people, it is the left brain that is the primary focus because most people work and function that way. And if you have a left brain, a left hemisphere stroke of some sort, it is possible, theoretically, to move those functions to the right hemisphere. but that will require, and the technology is not there yet. In fact, the understanding is not there yet even to begin to do this. And hopefully we can help with that, is to, through brain stimulation and through exercises, to move the speech area to the right hemisphere. Now, it happens that there are people who have had severe epilepsy, and they had normal speech and motor movements and so on, perceptions, but because of the severe epilepsy, they could not be treated any other way. The one hemisphere is removed. And if they remove the left hemisphere, one would expect, well, they're not going to be able to speak, and probably they won't be able to think very well. Well, it turns out that a left hemispherectomy, and these are teenagers that are undergoing this, they still can move all of those functions to the right hemisphere, because obviously they can function. They may have some right-sided weakness, paresis, because the muscle movements may not have been able to take over quite as thoroughly to the right. So the right hemisphere has got to do both the left and the right side of their body. But they can speak, and they can function and walk and so on. There may be some, again, weakness on the right side. But that gives you the idea, the hope, that, yes, we will be able to do that, even if it's, we don't remove a hemisphere, but there is severe damage to the left hemisphere.
And then with Alzheimer's, yeah. Robert?
Okay, and with Alzheimer's, yeah. Alzheimer's tends to be more global dysfunction, and it is possible if the neural electrical activity could be revived, then they would be able to be conscious, fully functional, or at least partially functional, where they are totally unfunctional now, dysfunctional. But we find also with Alzheimer's that at the end of life, so an Alzheimer's patient that has had aphasia and motor movements and so on are gone, don't remember anything, don't recognize anything, can't speak, at the end of life, they may have a terminal lucidity. In other words, all of a sudden, they're back. They can.
Yes,
they
I've seen that myself in the hospital.
Yes.
It's amazing.
And so they can speak, and they remember everything, and they're very close to death. So usually within a day, they die. But what is happening is, we think, is that the mind has loosened itself in the process of coming to die. The mind does loosen because it's going to separate from the physical body. And in loosening, quote-unquote loosening, it is able to function independent of the brain. And yet there will still be some functions like speech that can still continue. And memory comes back because, again, the memories are in the mind and not encoded in the brain. And
right.
So a lot of that function comes back, and they are lucid for a while. And, of course, this is part of the process of separating in the process of dying, and so they ultimately die.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could provoke that to happen sooner in the case of Alzheimer's, for instance, that where the mind could just take over and navigate the person for the rest of their lives?
Well, that would be very interesting. That would be very interesting. But it would be bringing people to this point of partially separating from the physical brain. And, okay, you say, okay, we've done that. Now, don't go any further.
Right.
So you can stick around.
I did want to ask you, because the brain, you think of the brain as something that has evolved in order to keep us from, in order to keep us surviving in the three-dimensional world. In other words, it's keyed to fight or flight reactions, and if you're hungry, if the body's hungry, it will pursue food and will behave selfishly.
Right.
Whereas the mind, being a more spiritual, hopefully wiser part of ourselves, it might be thinking more along, more like a guardian angel than like a voracious carnivore. And
right.
Do you see any conflict in that situation between the mind and the brain?
Yes. Yeah, you see that with people that have schizophrenia or people that have brain damage in the frontal lobes is that the part of the mind that can function, let's say, morally and with keeping behaviors intact, you know, in check so that one's higher self comes through, that still, you know, has to work through the brain. And so when there are brain anomalies or brain injury, particularly to the frontal lobe, they lose that ability. And actually in Alzheimer's as well, if it's frontal lobe Alzheimer's, they will become belligerent and aggressive.
I've seen that too.
Yeah, and so the mind is there, but the mind cannot work in the particular areas. One of the things in our theory is that the mind has to work in, you know, learns to work in specific areas of the brain. And so in the frontal lobes, and particularly the medial part, the middle part of the two hemispheres, right behind what we call the third eye, that is where you could say that our higher self works most, the anterior cingulate cortex on both hemispheres. And that, you know, is now recognized as an area where there are these interior endogenous thoughts and intuitions that come to people. That's where they come to consciousness, in this anterior cingulate cortex. And so when you have damage there, then you lose the ability to control your lower instincts.
I guess I've got time for one more question here. If the mind is something that has come from the light, or perhaps evolved out of past lives, why aren't the memories of what we call heaven or the memory of past lives come through to us in our current lives?
Well, actually, they do, or they can, but this may have to do with, you know, for most people, they don't, okay, unless you have a past life regression, and then usually you have difficulty verifying that that is, in fact, you, and there was a person back then that lived, and so on. But we forget about the heavenly realms, and we forget about past lives, because our purpose is to be on Earth, and in a way, our task is to find the path back to the spiritual world, back to the light, in our physical body, not in a near-death experience. That gives people a boost, you know.
A real insight.
Yeah, it's like, whoa, yeah, I didn't know that was there, but now I do. With the rest of us.
And yet our mind knew that it was there.
Yes. Well, yes, there is this intuition. Most people have this intuition. A lot of people repress it, but most people have this intuition that, yes, there is something higher.
Yeah.
And,
Robert, we're flat out of time, and I'm sorry, because this is such a fascinating topic. Let people know where they can find more on this, where they can find your YouTube and so forth.
Right. Well, if they go to the website selfconsciousmind.com, that's selfconsciousmind, all one word, .com, and all of our presentations are there. Our latest one is at the top there, and all of our work is summarized there.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, thank you so much, Robert and Suzanne, for sharing your mind-brain research with us today. And if the listeners would like to catch this show again or any of our past shows, just go to our website at nderadio.org. For information on IANS, check out that website at IANDS.org. And join us again next Monday, 11 a.m. Eastern, for more NDE Radio. This is Lee Whitting saying thanks for listening.